See, so good morning. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back again. Have another good discussion about Buddhism with you all. I look forward to this. Last talk was about the historical and the intellectual milieu at the time of the Buddha. If you weren't here, then that's what we talked about. There's quite a bit of information, really historical, in that talk. If you were here, there'll be some overlap. You'll recognize some things in today's talk from that last talk. Today, the title, The Buddha on Life and How to Live It, this is really teachings of the Buddha is what we're going to get into today. It's a foundational doctrine, and because of that, I wanted to give you as much of the Buddha's words or what's been reported to have been the Buddha's words as possible, and so that's why we have some handouts today. They'll go in the order of white, green, and then purple, and the green and purple have two sides. I'll tell you when we need them. We're gonna we'll start with them shortly. But first, let me just say that after the Buddha became enlightened, after he became awakened, became Buddha, he taught for roughly 45 years. Right? He spent about 6 years after he left the palace that his father's palace, wandering around, practicing various forms of religious austerities, meditation, yoga, various things, trying things out with different teachers and meditation, learning all sorts of stuff. And he came to this one really fateful moment where he went to the town of Bodhgaya, and underneath the famous Bodhi tree, this big tree, he meditated, and he came out of the meditation awakened, Buddha. And after that, everything changes for the all of history, world history changes, because he then teaches for 45 years and shares a wealth of knowledge with a lot of different people. And then after he passes away, this knowledge moves on and is taken on all sorts of different forms in the different cultures in which we find Buddhism situated. Now, when the Buddha talked about what it was he was teaching, he referred to that. Oops, as the Dharma Vinaya. Now, in the last talk, we saw Vinaya. And you've probably, or maybe you've heard of the word Vinaya before. In the Pali Canon, there are three baskets, Tripitaka. There's the Sutra Pitaka, or the basket of sayings, the things the Buddha said. There's a Vinaya basket, or the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the basket of the code of conduct for monks and nuns. And then there's the Abhidharma Pitaka, the basket of Abhidharma, which is a psychological and philosophical analysis of the sutras, of the things that the Buddha said. Well, Dharma, in the Buddhist context, that's really the content of today's talk. In Buddhism, means teaching, essentially. It can mean a variety of different things, but in this what we're talking about today, it simply means teaching. So it's the Dharma of the Buddha is the teaching of the Buddha. And what he talked about to his disciples and to his opponents, because there were many opponents, as we saw in the last talk, he said, you know, I'm teaching the Dharma Vinaya, and we translate that as the doctrine and the discipline, or the teaching and the discipline, essentially. Now, when scholars look at the Dharma Vinaya, if they want to, or if they're going to try to make Buddhism fit within what we call a category of religion, which Buddhism is usually classified in religious studies, if you look at the universities in this country, they say that this is really where we start to see a religion start to form in the context of the doctrine and the discipline. Essentially, the doctrine tells you what reality is, what life is, and the discipline tells you about how to go about living that life in that reality with certain goals. And the goals are going to come out today in some of the foundational doctrine that we talk about. Now, whether or not we want to say Buddhism's a religion is a really huge question. It opens up a big can of worms, especially for someone like myself who studies religion. And I have conversations with my colleagues all the time about what constitutes a religion. And Buddhism almost invariably throws a wrench into those definitions. Because one thing that it's missing, as we all know, is it's missing that divine, you know, infallible God concept or God being or what have you. Right? And that tends to be part of most definitions of religion that scholars use. That said, it still is usually studied in religious studies departments, and there's arguments to make the case that it is a religion. But when people talk about Buddhism as a religion, scholars especially, they're usually referring to this idea of what the Buddha called the Dharma Vinaya. So now, if we take a look at the white handout, this looks a little bit lengthy, but I hope you will indulge me and follow along with me. I'd like to read this here. This is a taken from the Sutra Pitaka. Here at the top of the page, it says Sutta Pitaka. That's the Pali rendering of what the Sanskrit would be, Sutra. It's called the Chalamalunkya Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, from the Sutra Pitaka. And this is a saying that has been passed on for a long time, that the Buddha, an exchange he had with one of his disciples who came to him sort of unsatisfied with the teachings that he had been getting. He said, you know, you'll see early on once we start reading this, that he's not happy with the range of knowledge that he's been getting. And he challenges the Buddha, and the Buddha takes that challenge and he addresses it. And then in a very typical sort of way that you see argumentation in the South Asian context at this time, right, about 2,500 years ago, he'll offer a little parable, and then he'll offer a lesson to be learned from the parable about what it is that he's doing. And this is a good place to start. One, because this is what the Buddha is supposed to have said. Two, it's going to bring us right into the most foundational doctrine of all for Buddhism, which comes at the end. And three, it gives us an idea of how the Buddha was actually engaging not only his disciples, but you could also imagine his disciple in this case as an opponent, maybe a Hindu or an Ajivika or a Jain, because this is what most of the texts read like when you see the Buddhists engaging other religious people as well. So we'll start here. The Venerable Malunkyaputta comes to the Master and expresses his astonishment that the Master's discourse leaves a series of the very most important and deepest questions unanswered. Is the world eternal, or is it limited by the bounds of time? Is the world infinite, or does it have an end? Is the living being identical with the body, or different from it? Does the perfect one, the Buddha, live on beyond death? Does the perfect one not live on beyond death? It pleases me not, says the monk, that all this should remain unanswered, and I do not think it right. Therefore, I come to the Master to interrogate him about these doubts. May it please the Buddha to answer them if he can. When anyone does not understand a thing and does not know it, then a straightforward man says, I do not understand that. I do not know that. And the Buddha answers him, what have I said to thee before now, Malunkyaputta? Have I said, come, Malunkyaputta, and be my disciple? I shall teach thee whether the world is everlasting or not everlasting, whether the world is finite or infinite, whether the vital faculty is identical with the body or separate from it, whether the perfect one lives on after death or does not live on, or whether the perfect one lives on and at the same time does not live on after death, or whether he neither lives on nor does not live on. That thou hast not said, sire. Or hast thou, the Buddha goes on, said to me, I shall be thy disciple. Declare unto me whether the world is everlasting or not everlasting, and so on. This also, Malunkyaputta must answer in the negative. A man, the Buddha proceeds, was struck by a poisoned arrow, and his friends and relatives called in a skillful physician. What if the wounded man said, I shall not allow my wound to be treated until I know who the man is by whom I have been wounded, whether he is a noble, a priest, a merchant, or a servant? Or what if, he said, I shall not allow my wound to be treated until I know what they call the man who has wounded me, of what family he is, whether he is tall, small, or of middle stature, and how the weapon with which he struck me was made. What would be the end of the case? Or what would the end of the case be? The man would die of his wound. Why has the Buddha not taught his disciples whether the world is finite or infinite, whether the accomplished one lives on beyond death or not? Because the knowledge of these things does not conduce to progress in holiness, because it does not contribute to peace and enlightenment. What contributes to peace and enlightenment, the Buddha has taught. The truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. Therefore, Malunkyaputta, whatsoever has not been revealed by me, let that remain unrevealed. And what has been revealed, let that be revealed. And so, this right here is a very sort of standard trope in the way in which the Buddha would teach his disciples or possibly argue with an opponent. And in that second to last paragraph, we get a version, and there are many versions, of what is really at the base of all Buddhist doctrine or all Buddhist teaching, and that is the Four Noble Truths. Right? These four truths. And before we get into them, and we'll go through them, and this now you can see on your green handout. The name the Four Noble Truths is a bit of a misnomer in the way that it's usually translated as the Four Noble Truths. First of all, and obviously I'm continuing the misnomer to some degree here by giving you a list right here. It gives us the impression that there's this sort of list that the Buddha had jotted down, point one, point two, point three, point four, when in fact the Buddha was more concerned with a method. Right? There's a content and a method that he was interested in conveying. And a list can sometimes mislead us into thinking more about the form than the method. So I would just like to point that out. But that's usually the way it's passed on. Why might that be? Later traditions, we definitely see this as a list form, and again, you're seeing it today. This is pretty common in the history of religions for various teachings to be systematized in a kind of list form, or in a way that can be easily remembered, and therefore passed on from generation to generation. And that's where we see this sort of listing of these truths come. The second thing that's important to note comes from the translation, the Four Noble Truths. The Sanskrit is Chatvari Arya Satyani, right? And the word for noble is Arya right here. Now, if we look at all the places, or a variety of the places in which the Buddha gives these four truths, the lesson of these four truths, right? And we try and figure out why are we translating this as the Four Noble Truths? It doesn't really make sense. In fact, it's not the truths that are noble, right, with the Buddha's teaching. Instead, he's taking a word here, Arya, which is a very old word. It's from the Rig Veda going back to 1200 BCE, which is part of the last talk. If you were here, you would have maybe remembered it. It's what the people who produced that text referred to themselves as. They said that they were Aryas. They were noblemen. And they're bringing this information, right? The Rig Veda, where we find that myth about social stratification that is not to be argued with, right? It's still in effect in some very serious senses in South Asia today. And he's reinterpreting it. And this is really important to keep in mind, is that the Buddha is responding to the things that were around him, arguing against them, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in overt ways. But he had to work within the language and the concepts and the ideas of the things that were around him and available to him so that people could understand him, first of all, and perhaps agree with him, or, he was open to argument, too. It's a very much part of the culture. But instead, what he interprets, or what he makes Arya in this sense to mean, is rather, these are four truths for nobles. And in nobles, in this case, refers to somebody who's spiritually superior, or somebody who is determined to take a spiritual path, right? It's not that the truths themselves are noble. And that's an important thing to note, because you wouldn't know that just from reading the Four Noble Truths. You just sort of think, well, these truths are really, really special. But one truth is noble just as much as the next truth is noble if it's seriously truth, right? That's just something to keep in mind. So we start now. We look at the handout here, and I'll put those four points on your green handout up here, and then I'll give you a passage that the Buddha is thought to have said from the Sutra Pitaka about this one. I have to crick my neck here to see it. So, life is by nature saddled with suffering. This is the first of the Four Noble Truths. Again, we saw this here. This is the truth of suffering. All of life is suffering. This, O monks, is the truth of suffering. Dukkha is the Sanskrit word. Birth is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. To be united with the unloved is suffering. To be separated from the loved is suffering. Not to obtain what one desires is suffering. In short, clinging to earthly things is suffering. Everything is suffering in life, essentially. And a couple things that are important to note in this, I think, are, one, he talks about suffering here in a grand sort of bookends of life. Birth and death are both suffering. So you start life, you're suffering, you're ending life, you're usually suffering. And that's physical suffering for most people, right? And with birth, they're suffering for the mother who's giving birth, usually for the child too, right? At death, there's often suffering for the person who's dying. And if not, very fortunate. But there's also often suffering for people who love the one who's dying. And so this spans out into a big web of suffering for other people as well. But he also talks about things that are more everyday and more emotional sorts of things that also cause suffering. Having to spend time with people that you don't want to spend time with, he says in this passage right here, is suffering. Right? Being separated from the people you love is suffering. And clinging, right? This is a big one. Clinging to earthly things is suffering. All these things are conducive to suffering. Right? They all lead to suffering. Now, why is there an asterisk here? Well, the word dukkha, it's okay to translate it as suffering. It works that way. It does mean suffering. But often if we think of suffering in English, if I just throw that word out, I reckon everybody in this room, mind is going to a different place if you try and attach suffering to something. We may be thinking about it in terms of the hangnail that you had last night, or maybe you're thinking about something much bigger, like the atrocities that are going on in Syria, or you know, some historical event that was really awful. You know, we could all attribute suffering to those various things. They could be very small in the grand scale, they could be very huge. Dukkha also means, and if you pick up a textbook on Buddhism, you may see people translate it as unsatisfactoriness down here. Suffering in this sense means those big things, but it also means anything that leaves you unsatisfied. You need more, right? I love to collect something, you know, but I keep getting all these things that I, you know, like my son right now loves Hot Wheels, and he just keeps wanting more and more Hot Wheels. And he says, if I just get that one racer or whatever it is, I don't need any more. And then, of course, we go back to the same store where he got it, and he needs the next two, and he needs the next two. It's just, it may lead to states of mind that perpetuate themselves, and need more and more and more and more. And so unsatisfactoriness is also a way to think about what dukkha is in this case. The reason, or I think what underlies the suffering in this first really fundamental truth that the Buddha taught, is that all these things are impermanent. They come and they go, and we have no control over that at the end of the day. You may have something for a long time, or a good collection of the things that you want for a while you have it, but at the end of the day, you know, or at the end of the week or the month or whatever, it's not going to be really where you want it to be. And then life comes and goes. These things are impermanent, and that lack of control over our future is at the heart of that. The term for that is anitya. Nothing's permanent, right, is what he's saying. This is what causes the suffering. The second truth that he says is that thirst gives rise to suffering. Thirst, and I'll explain why he uses the term thirst in a minute. Says, this, O monks, is the truth of the origin of suffering. It is thirst. And the Sanskrit word is tirshna. Pali, maybe you've heard, is tanha, which leads from birth to birth, together with lust and desire, which finds gratification here and there. The thirst for pleasures, the thirst for being, the thirst for non-existence through self-abnegation. Denying oneself of things. That last point, something that he experienced personally when he left the palace of his father and he went off into the wilderness and tried various forms of yoga and meditation, and he deprived himself of, through fasting and through various religious austerities, to the point of where he almost died. Right? That is also included in this as a form of thirst. It's the thirst that gives rise to suffering. Now, why thirst? Thirst, I think, and others have also said this, is that thirst is something that at a very human base level we can all relate to. It's a physical, a bodily, a somatic thing, experience. We all know that what the experience is. You're thirsty, you take some liquids, the thirst goes away, but it comes back, right? It goes away and it comes back no matter how much liquid you drink, right? You're going to be thirsty again. It's a self-perpetuating sort of thing. This, the Buddhists call, in the later traditions, they call it a klesha, which is an afflicted state of mind. We have these afflicted states of mind, thirst, greed, seeking pleasure, envy, jealousy, a variety of these afflicted states of mind tend to lead to more afflicted states of mind, or lead to actions that lead to more afflicted states of mind, in the same way that, famously, in one of the Buddha's teachings, if you have a fire out in the woods, you give it some wood, it burns it up, and it wants more wood. It just keeps burning. And then if you give it the opportunity, it will just rage on and rage on and rage on and never stop if it's continued to be fed fuel or wood. That's thirst is like that. And I think it's meant to be a very somatic sort of example so that people can relate to it very quickly and regularly. The next one is, there is a state beyond suffering. This one, when I teach this, the Four Noble Truths, to some of my students, I phrased it this way on purpose. This is not what he said in the example from the Chula Malunkya Putta Sutta that we read. He says that the truth of the cessation of suffering, that's the third truth. But later traditions use this truth as a way to elaborate a really important concept in Buddhism that for some schools of Buddhism is absolutely central. For other schools, it's not so central. You probably have an idea of what that state might be right now. Does anybody have a guess as the state is beyond?
Enlightenment? Nirvana?
Yes, that's it. And I'm going to come back to that after we see what the Buddha had to say about this truth right here. But I phrase it this way because of the importance that later traditions talk about this truth, and also because a lot of times when people are coming at Buddhism for the first time, which a lot of my students in college are, they see those first two as real, just like devastating realizations. And the third one is more of an upbeat sort of thing. It's that there's a state beyond it. And so to phrase it this way, you know, I think brings them back into a kind of... that brings their attention back to really what the Buddha was after, rather than to just scare you and to say, you know, everything's bad. You know, it's really painful. Because that's not what it's true, but it's not really what it's all about. So he said about this truth, this, O monks, is the truth of the cessation of suffering, the cessation of this thirst by the complete annihilation of desire, letting it go, expelling it, separating oneself from it, giving it no room. You eliminate all thirst in your life, and you do that. You accomplish that, and you've blown out or extinguished that fire, right, that we just described as, you know, spreading as long as you keep giving it fuel. And what is that blown out? I put that in quotes because it's a translation of nirvana. That's really what nirvana means. Right? It means blown out or extinguished. If you can get rid of all the thirst, all of those afflicted states of mind, right, that keep us doing various things and keep us acting in certain sorts of ways that perpetuate, right, one another, then we can attain this state. Now, what the Buddha often said, the worst or the most devastating, rather, state of mind, afflicted state of mind, that people cannot overcome, is the belief that they have a self when in fact they don't have a self. And it's this constant preoccupation and attention and concern for or defense of one's ego. Right? Ego here in the sense of I. You know, I, me, me, me. That concern to draw attention to myself, to worry about what myself is going to do amid a group of people and how I can individuate myself and be different from all of you and have a different seat and different wardrobe or whatever. You can imagine this in all sorts of different ways. That concern with the self, right, is what keeps perpetuating a need for more and more sense pleasures, a need for more and more greed or more greedy activities. And this just all breeds more and more concern for the ego. But if you can blow that out, you can eliminate all thirst and you can attain the state of nirvana. Now, the Buddha didn't talk about nirvana as much as you might think, given that it's such a central concept in later traditions. He did address it because he has this third truth where he says you can stop thirst, and there's certainly something beyond it. But a lot of people, including his disciples, would say, just as Malunkyaputta sort of did, he didn't use the word nirvana, but he said, what happens after death? You know, what goes on when the perfect one dies, when the Buddha dies? And people, even his opponents, would address it more directly and say, what's this nirvana concept of blowing out, you know, all of these thirsts? And if you blow out all of those thirsts, then you're not reborn into the cycle of life, and we know that life is suffering. So you eliminate thirst, you eliminate suffering by eliminating being reborn. That's what nirvana is. And he would respond, usually he'd respond by saying, you know, you shouldn't worry about nirvana, right? It's a red herring. It'll take your mind off of what's the most important thing, and the most important thing is to realize that there's suffering all around, everywhere, and trying to get to the root of it, get to the cause of it, and eliminating that. If you're too preoccupied with nirvana, chances are you're probably too concerned with yourself and what's going to happen down the road. And so he didn't like to address it, and he didn't address it all that often. Later schools of Buddhism develop huge theories of nirvana, enormous theories about these blissful state, right? And get very psychological about it in terms of what happens to one when they attain this state. What we find in the oldest texts, the South Asia, among the 18 schools that were the early schools of Buddhism in South Asia, is there are two ways that nirvana is discussed. And they're almost interchangeable. First, nirvana with existence. And the term for that is bodhi. And bodhi means perfect knowledge by which one becomes Buddha. So when the Buddha went to Bodh Gaya, had that famous meditation where he was grappling with the demon Mara, who was throwing things at him, afflicted states of mind like greed, envy, lust, ego, all these things, and the Buddha repelled them while he was meditating. And he came out of his meditation awakened. He came out with bodhi, this perfect knowledge, and he was thereafter Buddha, awakened. But he didn't just die, right? It's not as though you just die and you're no longer brought into the cycle of rebirth. This is, he lived, these texts say, he was living in a state of nirvana for 45 years while he taught. But then other texts make a distinction that there's also what they call parinirvana. And when the Buddha at the age of 80 famously had a bad meal, right, that made him ill, this is what's supposed to have made him finally, his body die or end, stop working, he took parinirvana, or the final nirvana. And then it's all done. He escapes from the cycle of rebirth and redeath. And I'll just stress one more time that nirvana becomes so very different for different Mahayana Buddhist schools than, say, these early Buddhist schools, that there's just no real way to really put it into a nutshell. But think of it in terms of just blowing out the cycle of rebirth and redeath. That's literally what the term means, by getting rid of this thirst. So we get to number four, or the fourth truth. The means to eradicate suffering is the Eightfold Path. This, O monks, is the truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. It is the Eightfold Path, to wit, right views, right resolution, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right exertion, right mindfulness, right concentration. Where I have right up here, the word is samyak, it could also be perfected. You might see that sometimes, perfected speech, perfected action. Either way is fine. If you turn your hand out, the green one over, you've got the Eightfold Path here. I don't think we need to go through all this, and you can certainly ask questions about this if you have any. But these are the eight things that are listed right here. I'll just like to draw our attention to number four, right action. And this one here is subdivided with 10 points after it. And these 10 points are Buddhist precepts or obligations, the first five of which are for all Buddhists, laity included, so lay Buddhists as well. The 10 are for Buddhist monks and nuns. If you look into certain Buddhist traditions, different schools, you'll see many, many more. The Theravadins, for example, are famous. I think it's 227. Obligations that they have. It's quite exhausting. They get very particular. It sounds really exhaustive, but it's probably not as hard to follow once you start following the big ones, I would think. But one thing to look at this is, you know, I think a common question for people is, you know, if desire or thirst is at the heart of suffering in the world, these desires, these, you know, cravings for things, then how do we make sense of this, you know, need to try and get to a state beyond it, if that's kind of desire too, Right? This is built into, right? You know, it seems a little bit unusual that that's the way it would be discussed. The Buddhists have a way to deal with this, and well, one is they say, and the Buddhists said, but later traditions say more emphatically, that nirvana is not something you lust after or desire in the way that you would desire to please your senses. It's something you aspire towards, which is a difference. But also, there are different forms of actions or motivations for actions. Ones that are motivated by tirshna or thirst are invariably bad. They produce what we call bad karma. And bad karma has to play itself out somewhere, and it has to play itself out in life. And if you've got a lot of it, it's going to play out in the next life or the next life after that. It's going to keep going until you've played it all out. But there are other actions or motivations which are called chanda, is the term they use, which aren't necessarily bad. In fact, they can actually lead you down the path the way the Buddha designed it to be. These are okay, these sorts of motivations. And if we look at point four on the Eightfold Path here, and we go down to the third obligation, misconduct involving sense pleasure or sexual conduct. The first five are for all Buddhists, the laity included. And of course, among the laity in a Buddhist community, there are couples, right? And the Buddha never said, nor did any later tradition say, that they should not be, a couple should not be sexually desirous of one another. This is okay, right? This is an example of chanda, an action that does not get in the way of one's path towards enlightenment, towards nirvana. There are things that can be done that are okay in that regard. Good actions, bad actions. Good motivations, bad motivations, in other words. All right. Now, this takes us out of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths and the truth of suffering, all of life is suffering, is really the bedrock for everything that comes after in Buddhist doctrine, everything the Buddha said. And it's one thing, it's maybe the one thing, across Buddhist traditions that you see consistently. It's consistently there without much variation, whereas other things, like the concept of nirvana, will have a wide variety of interpretations and emphasis in the Buddhist schools. So this is really, really important. It is the foundation. In the second truth, thirst is the cause of suffering. The idea of these afflicted states of mind that lead people to act in certain ways that are motivated by thirst, right? These things keep people in the cycle of rebirth and re-death because they produce bad karma. Amongst those afflicted states of mind, the belief in a self, in yourself or in anyone's self, when there's not a self, is perhaps the hardest to get over, is what the Buddha said. And he addresses that with the doctrine of not-self. And if you look at the Sanskrit here, on Atman. Atman is a term that was in vogue at the time the Buddha was teaching. If you remember the history from the last talk, the Upanishads, a collection of texts that came at the very end of the Vedic period, the sages who produced those texts said, you know, we probably shouldn't be worried so much about ensuring a good rebirth like we have been for the last 600-700 years by performing good sacrifices, but rather seems like every time we're born again, we die, and there's pain involved in that. There's suffering. With every rebirth, there's a re-death, is what they started to focus on, and this death idea. And so they wanted to come up with a way to eliminate that pain, and they talked about releasing this self that everyone has into a state of absolute reality, it's called. But you can only do that by correcting your actions over time. Right? Very similar to what the Buddha said. But what they said was is that what happens after you attain this release from the cycle of rebirth and re-death is that your Atman, just this word right here, goes on and lives in some state of bliss. There's different ways for describing it. And this Atman is what goes from body to body to body through rebirth and the transmigratory journey. And it's unchanged by anything that happens in your lifetime. So we're born, it's painful, you get sick in your lifetime, it's painful, you break an arm, you do whatever, something happens, and then you die. Your body, your physical self, your mental self is always afflicted by these things, but your Atman never changes, Right? It just goes on until you're able to release it from this painful existence of life. The Buddha, using the language of these philosophers, says that, well, no, that's not it. I've already said that one of his biggest concerns for people of why they're stuck in the cycle of rebirth and redeath is that they're too preoccupied with their own ego. Right? This is what keeps them acting in certain ways that produces bad karma. And so he came up with this theory called anatman. And just like we sometimes will attach the letter A to terms to negate them, like atemporal or ahistorical, in Sanskrit you can do that with A or an, and you have anatman. So it's not self. This is what he said we should be thinking about. And he then had to explain what it is that you are and what it is that I am. If I'm standing here and you're standing here, what are we, right? If we're not just a physical form with some pure unchanging thing like these philosophers in India were saying. So if you look at the purple handout, So this doctrine says that people tend to misidentify things that do not have a self as having a self. This was very common for the people the Buddha was encountering during his lifetime. And that this preoccupation with the self gets in the way of what becomes a foundational or really important Buddhist virtue, which is compassion. Right? You can't be compassionate, the Buddha said, unless you can overcome thoughts of your own well-being. Right? How many times, you know, do you talk to somebody, whether it's in person or on the phone or video chat or wherever, and you're talking, somehow you're able to talk and hold a conversation, and yet you're thinking about, you know, tasks that you have to do or that you just did or what somebody said to you. You're still thinking about yourself. True compassion can't happen in that situation. And if life is suffering for everyone, you can't truly see the suffering of other people as long as you're still wrapped up in your own ego. And this is what the Buddha is saying, that theory of the Upanishads, of those Hindu philosophers, they're never going to get to that state. And for the Buddha, that's an important state to get to. And so he said that, let's not talk about the self the way you've been talking about it, but what happens in rebirth and redeath is that a new person is formed every time. And he used the term person that is a mix, a convergence. Each one of us is just a convergence of different processes that comes together. And those things are called skandhas, is the term he used. They're different aggregates, and there are five of them that come together with every rebirth. And those five are listed right here, the bottom of your sheet. There's a material form, or your body. Right? This is the one that we see whenever we encounter people. A person we engage immediately on the basis of their body, right? Their physical form. The sensations, perceptions, dispositions, and consciousness. That's it. Obviously, missing from this list, so if the Buddha is giving a sermon, if I'm, you know, a Buddhist giving a sermon to a bunch of Hindus who subscribe to the idea of a self, and you ask me, well, what is the person comprised of? I just say those five things. You're all shaking your head, going, well, where's the sixth thing? You would be waiting for this idea of a self that goes on, that's unchanged, that's perfect, that you're trying to release. It's just not there in Buddhism. And the Buddha never... Well, it's arguable whether he expressly said there is no self. He talked about the self because other people were talking about it, his opponents. But he doesn't come out and expressly say there is no existent self. He doesn't say that. He says your preoccupation with the self will never get you to where I'm saying is a good place to be. It's a red herring. It's a hindrance to your spiritual progress towards enlightenment, is what he says. Later traditions, again, I keep saying later traditions, but it's true. Later traditions take the sayings of the Buddha and make more doctrine with it. They say, there is no self, absolutely no self, not at all. Never was, never will be. Anybody who thinks it is misguided. Why? Well, this is an important question to ask when anybody says anything, I suppose, but if it's something really weighty, you want to ask why. So what are the Buddhas doing? What are they doing when they deny the self? Well, we know a little bit about the context in which the Buddha lived, and he did it perhaps in a more subtle way, but denying the self, right? Whether you do it subtly or whether you just say, no, there's no self, is a political statement at this time. It's an ideological statement at this time. It's positioning yourself in such a way where you're rejecting the dominant strain of thought. And the Buddha was doing that. There's no question about that. And Buddhists later absolutely did it. And that's profound. And it's profound because you reject that dominant thought of the Atman coming from a tradition that set up a social system based upon birth, based upon your mother and father, right? Based upon your birth, you're stuck in a certain level in society, likely to be reborn there again over and over and over. And if you're at the top, you have access and privileges to things, so the texts say, that will enable you to have a better rebirth or continue at those rebirths. And the Buddha came out and said, no, right? Your belief in this self that's existing at this sort of level according to this social structure just doesn't work. And by him saying there's no self that lives in this way from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime, it's a very political statement. And for Buddhists later, it continued to be. And it was more overtly a political statement against things like that, this social stratification. Well, why? Because if we believe that you and I and everyone are just five components that are coming and going, and the me that's here today is just a convergence of these five things, but it's a different convergence of these five things than it was when I was standing here before you in February, right? These things come and go all the time. And if I were to walk behind the screen over there, it would be a different convergence. I would be a different person. None of that is pure, unchanging self, like those philosophers were saying. Right? There's nothing that's not changing. This is what physics tells us. This is the appeal for some people. It's very logical in this sense. Then humanity's all the same. Right? No matter what your capabilities are right now, you're just this convergence of these five things. We're all the same. There shouldn't be a system of social hierarchy in the way that it's been set up, in other words. He's rejecting that, saying it in so many words.
Anthony?
Oh, yeah.
You haven't mentioned it, but I think it's also integral to this concept.
Yeah.
Denying the self also implies the opposite, which is that we are all interconnected. We're all interdependent.
Yes. That's the next doctrine.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. It's true. One doctrine needs another in many ways. This is what's so complicated about it, is that, you know, these are big, big ideas that need elaboration. And the next doctrine of dependent co-arising explains why everything comes up together. I wouldn't be here if you all weren't here. You wouldn't be here if I weren't here. And, you know, that kind of thing. There are conditions that brought these five things to converge in my form right here today. And, you know, likewise for all of you, according to this theory. That's the next one. So, yeah, you're right there. Yeah. One other thing to say. It's a political comment, but it's also a spiritual cultivation practice. It's not just political. And what I mean by that is that the doctrine of no self is also used in a form of what's called mindful meditation, where mindfulness is cultivated in the person, Vipassana meditation, where a monk will meditate on the various parts, components of the body. 32 is a very common number for the list of things. So these five, and then their subparts. But there could be more. And initially, a monk will recite these verbally out loud, and then over time, as he or she becomes more skilled at this, they'll internalize that sort of recitation of the different parts of the body. Of course, there's no Atman. There's nothing on there on that list that is not subject to change. Right? Anything that's in life, earthly, is subject to change always. And the idea is that as you start to internalize this list of things, you don't just realize it and then move on and then go make supper and, you know, forget about it, but it becomes a permanent sort of activity in your life, almost unconsciously or internally, even when you're walking, doing your chores, doing whatever. So you're mindful always of the fact that you're not a self, but you're just a conglomeration of these different aggregates coming together, of which the self is not a part. And that opens yourself up to other people a lot more, right, than if you're preoccupied with the ego. So it's political, but it's also a means to self-cultivation. So now if we turn over the handout, we get to what Brian was just talking about. So if there is rebirth, because he talked about rebirth and redeath, he had to explain what causes people to come about. What happens when people arrive here as this confluence of five different components, these five aggregates, these skandhas. And he came up with a doctrine which we call the doctrine of dependent co-arising, paticca-samuppada, which this is the Sanskrit here. You'll also see this translated as, in the parenthetical note here, conditioned origination. That's clumsier, but it's a little bit closer to what the actual Sanskrit is. It's something like the rising up together in response to something. Right? You only come about because of other things that are already in place. And now this is specifically just about the individual, right? This theory as we have it here. But it applies to a larger matrix of things too, like Brian was just suggesting. That is, everything I'm doing, if you're around, and everything you're doing, if I'm around, are going to have an effect on what we do, what we are, what we think, how we act, and so on and so forth. So, but this right here, as we're about to go through, is more just about the individual. So let's look at this here. So in the abstract, dependent co-arising expresses a principle that mental and physical phenomena only originate and exist when appropriate conditioning factors are present. There have to be things that are present in order for other things to come about. If something's not there, nothing comes about. If you don't like the cause, if you don't like the effect, don't produce the cause. In other words, right? If you don't like the effect, don't produce the cause. It's fairly simple. Hard to practice. Fairly simple to understand. There's a famous verse right here on your handout. It says, when this is, that comes to be. From the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, that does not come to be. From the non-arising of this, that does not arise. You see that over and over and over in texts that are concerned about why things are happening the way they're happening. In everyday application, this doctrine presents this list of 12 conditioning factors or preconditions that explain causation, why things come into existence. And again, you could read this in part as a refutation of what the Hindus, the Ajivikas, the Jains were saying at the time of the Buddha. It's a comment on that, because they were talking about these things too, and the Buddha had to address them because he's using the same sorts of intellectual scaffolding, so to speak, in order to get his ideas out there. And he won a lot of disciples because of it. This is also the nature of argumentation in South Asia at this time. You win your disciples by winning arguments. Right? These arguments, they aren't violent, they're verbal, and they're highly structured, and if you win, you often take over the disciples who are with the other person that you just bested, right? And so he had to work within that scaffolding at the time. So if we look at these 12 preconditions, these, again, it's a list. The Buddha didn't carry around this list, laminated. So he used it so many times. This is put together by later tradition, and I'm giving it to you in a way that I think these are the same 12 points. I'm using a slightly different language than you would see if you picked up a textbook on Buddhism, but the 12 points would still be there. So if we start, number one, ignorance about the Four Noble Truths leads to dispositions, concerns, and intentions, or karma, that direct consciousness. And it's consciousness, the Buddha said, that enters after death into rebirth. So right there, there's a parallel to what we see the Hindus talking about. The Hindus said that after death, the Atman goes on into a new body, into rebirth. The Buddha said it was not, there's no Atman. Consciousness is where we see the continuity from life to life to life, if we can see any continuity at all. Given that living beings are sustained in the cycle of rebirth through consciousness, the dispositions that direct consciousness, how you're predisposed towards things, right? That's what's directing your consciousness. Those things enter and develop in the womb at the start of life. So when a new life is being formed, that's when a disembodied consciousness, they say, enters into the womb and develops alongside of this fetus, this developing fetus. And so that fetus, right? In the in the Judeo-Christian traditions, is this quickening, I think, maybe? When something happens, the soul enters the body, the way to describe it. In this sense here, consciousness enters that developing fetus. And that developing fetus is now carrying whatever dispositions that were with that consciousness in the previous lifetime into this body. Connected with consciousness in this growing being, the new being develops a body, right? Various limbs and things form in utero, as well as the six senses with which she or he will come into contact with the external world. So there's one more sense than we have in the Western tradition. Does anyone know what the sixth sense in Buddhism might be?
Mind,
yeah, exactly. The mind is the sixth sense in Buddhism. The other five are the same. At birth, there is contact of the sense organs with their objects. So, your sense organ of sight comes in contact with images. This is the way it's described. From which, sensations arise. And because of that, you get things like pleasure and pain. So the sensations, they have their contact in the world with good sights, good sounds, bad sounds. Good taste, bad taste, touches, and so on, thoughts with the mind, that produce pleasure or pain. Passions. They awaken the passions. Number eight, but above all, thirst. This is really important now. Which clings to the sense pleasures and the ego. Thirst and the ego are so intimately entwined for the Buddha in this case. And this leads to, if you're connected to the ego, if you're looking for pleasure and pain because you want to make yourself feel better or not feel bad, or whatever it is you want to do to advance your ego, yourself, you're going to keep acting in ways that this fire spreads, in the way that he talked about fire just looking for more fuel, or thirst needing more satiation. This leads to, point 11, rebirth, and point 12, the suffering of aging and dying that comes with existence. These are 12 points. It's a lot, right? You know, there's a lot of information right there. The thing to keep in mind is, I give a little synopsis of the way it's broken down, and that's why you'll see there's a break between 7 and 8. And if you like, you can look at these, take these, obviously, that's why I made them. You can take and look at them later. Is that 1 to 7 describes how a new being is born. This is the way it's sort of set up and how we can understand this. And its consciousness is the carrier that after death enters a new incarnation. And it's the dispositions, concerns, and intentions that influence one's consciousness. How we're disposed to do things, what our intentions are, and what our concerns are, anxieties and so on, they affect that consciousness, which it says a newborn life is growing up with from moment one, right? Really early on. And that enters the womb, develops as part of the body with sense faculties, and allows the new body to engage the world. This gives the new body sensations like pleasure and pain. On this side, points 1 to 7, the dispositions, concerns, and intentions are called the conditioning factors. Now, if we want to address Brian's question earlier, if we think about this in terms of ethics, social ethics, your dispositions, concerns, and intentions are going to produce actions in your interpersonal relationships that are going to have an effect on the way in which another person is living. Absolutely. And likewise. And they may be obvious, they may not be obvious. These could be things that are built in a way that, you know, extend over lifetimes that we may not be entirely clear about. So we can expand this from the individual to social as well. Numbers 8 to 12 are an elaboration of essentially the first two noble truths. Old age, dying, etc. This is suffering. Are conditioned by birth and new existence and have as their cause thirst. So thirst, again, is at the baseline of these right here. I think I've given you a lot of information, so I'm just going to stop. I'm going to stop right there. I hope that, you know, I wanted to get through all three. But you can take these, and if you have more questions, or if you have questions right now, certainly take them. But if you have any more about these, I'm back again. Yes?
These dispositions in Numbers 1 through 7 sound very much like what we speak of as karma.
Yep.
How the consciousness is formed in a new being is a result of the karma that it, the consciousness brings with it.
Yeah.
Would you say that was accurate?
Yep. And in fact, I believe there's a, it says on point two in parentheses, it says karma right after dispositions, concerns, and intentions.
I didn't see that.
That's okay. That's exactly right. That's how it's understood. That's perfect. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
and this has to do with probably terminology. You're talking about an entity called consciousness that can move from incarnation to incarnation, and that this entity consciousness is different from Atman. But when I, in my other school where I learned the meaning of Atman, the word consciousness was used to describe it, that the self was a kind of transmigrating consciousness. So help me to understand the difference between what you mean by consciousness and what you meant by Atman.
Well, they're two different terms. If we look at the handout here, consciousness is vijnana, is the term for consciousness in Buddhism, and Atman is Atman. And Atman is, they're both, those are both the Sanskrit words. Atman is a term that can be used as a reflexive pronoun. Myself is really what the word can mean. And it really just, and it often is used as an I or an ego. I do this for myself. And the term that would be used there, if it were just a drama or a play or a comedy or something, could be Atman. In philosophy, it means something different. It means this immaterial, permanent, joyful thing that's sort of caged in this body, caged in this body that needs to be released through that cycle of transmigration. Vijnana comes from a root that is tied to jnana, which means knowledge. It's more related to mental faculties and things like the dispositions, the way in which you engage the world at an intellectual level. This is at the real, this is at the textual level. Those would be the differences in the terms. Does that help?
It does a little bit. It's kind of, it's a little bit vague, and it's probably because I have to think about it some more.
And it's, and you know, we're also looking at it from two different traditions too. And so it could be that the way in which they're described, or the way in which that you've had it described to you, may be a way that, you know, I don't know what that way was, but they're working with similar terms at this point in time, and they're splitting hairs with them to try and distinguish one another often, and that could be where there could be some overlap and also some differentiation, perhaps, is
okay.
Where maybe some confusion could be drawn.
Yeah, I think it's possible. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. When we think or speak of rebirth, we usually are thinking of self associated with it. Very much following her question there. And it seems to be, I'm very limited in my understanding, to confess to that. Consciousness that is reborn is not self. That's correct.
That's what the Buddha said. Yeah.
And so when we speak of rebirth, we're not thinking of the rebirth of a self. We're thinking of just one. You can't really call consciousness even an aspect of self. It's totally different.
They're totally different things. And for the and for Buddhists, there is no self.
Right.
Yeah.
So
in the equation.
There is no self in the equation. So what's reborn is not self.
Right.
It's simply conscious.
Consciousness is what carries over the continuity, those dispositions that you acquire over time. Maybe this is, maybe this will be helpful. The difference, a big difference is the Atman is unchanging. It's perfect. It's immaterial. It's part of the only true reality for these sages of the Upanishads. After it's released from the cycle of rebirth and redeath, from going into body after body, whether it's a human body or a goat or a, you know, a tree or whatever body it is, a living body, it is released into the like a drop of water into a bucket of water, and the bucket of water is absolute reality. The Atman drops into it, you can no longer see it anymore. It goes back to that one true reality. Consciousness is part of life. It changes. Your dispositions, your intentions, your anxieties, and your concerns change too from time to time to time. That's why the Anthony Cirilli that was here in February, right? Those five things that were here standing as one sort of, you know, whole before you, giving you the talk about history, I had a consciousness there that was motivated by and had certain dispositions, anxieties, and concerns, is a different consciousness than the one here today, I think. You know, there's a psychologist in the room who could probably sort that out for me. But those things change in the same way they change from week to week to day, from life to life to life, too. Whereas the Atman doesn't have any of that. The Atman experiences nothing, is what the Hindu philosophers say.
So in Buddhism, in Hinduism, the universe is alive, and it's alive with consciousness. But in Buddhism, the universe is not alive, it simply exists.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, because what I learned about consciousness in studying Vedic philosophy was that the universe itself has a sense of awareness. That the whole universe has a sense of awareness. And what I think I'm understanding from you is that the idea that the universe has an awareness is absent from Buddhist thinking. That awareness is only something that goes with people.
No. I'm not sure. I'm still not sure I completely understand what you mean by the idea of the universe having an awareness. Mm-hmm. Living beings have awareness. And the universe can, you know, a lot sentient beings all have awareness. As a whole, the universe having a collective awareness? I don't know if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I don't want to distract your lecture. We can talk about it later.
Maybe we could talk after. But yeah, there are similarities. Again, I just highlight the fact that Buddha's working with similar terminology in order to try and draw a distinction. And that's maybe where we see a little overlap in this.
Well, mine is just really quick, because last time you talked about the distinctions between the two major schools of Buddhism right now, Theravada and Mahayana.
Yep.
And you spoke of the Atman versus the Bodhisattva as being key distinctions. Am I right with that? Is that
Arhat. Arhat in Theravada.
Oh, okay. Yep. Okay. I misunderstood. Okay.
No, the Arhat is the sort of paradigmatic figure for these Theravada and the old Buddhist schools from South Asia. And the Arhat is a person who attains Nirvana, attains Bodhi, that perfect state of knowledge that the Buddha attained after his awakening, or with his awakening, and they escape from the cycle of rebirth and re-death at the death of their body. Mahayana puts a different spin on this, and they have a paradigmatic figure as a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva, an enlightened being, or an awakened being, really is what it means, is somebody who also attains that state of perfect knowledge, but takes a vow, the bodhisattva vow, not to go into parinirvana, that final nirvana, but to exist often in, you know, some celestial. They're only superficially tied to our earthly world. They have superpowers, and they live in heavens, and they live, you know, sometimes show up on earth and sometimes go away. And the reason that they come and go is to help other people on the Buddhist path towards their goal. And they vow not to go into parinirvana until everybody can go. The Arhat just goes. And that's not to downplay it. It's an enormous achievement, but it's the major difference. And so, you know, a lot of early Western scholars of Buddhism looked at the Bodhisattva figure and said, "Oh, well, this is their guardian angel," you know, to our Christian guardian angel. This is the parallel, because this is the way that scholars from the West early on always, you know, made the comparisons and tried to make it fit into those traditions. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's the difference. Yep.
I'm just going to mention that as far as the question about the Atman versus consciousness, something that Roshi often mentions in introductory workshops is that the notion that that in Buddhism we're not talking about the transference of a thing, but rather the continuation of a process. And maybe that's one way to.
It's perfect. Look that's at very it. Good. That's exactly it. Yeah, it's what we are. We're just We are a conglomerate of processes. And rebirth would just be that. Exactly. That's good. Yeah. And I was lucky enough that I got to hear the morning part of the workshop yesterday for people interested in the center. And so it's the first time I heard Roshi talk. And I'm not sure he was speaking about some of this stuff yesterday. It was great. It was wonderful. And I don't know if he said that or not.
It was later toward the end.
It was at the end. So I missed that part. But yeah, that's a good, I think, explanation. I think this gentleman has hand up first.
In Tibetan Buddhism, when you hear about like reincarnations of Dalai Lamas and so on, what's being reincarnated there? Because aren't they supposed to be enlightened, or?
Yeah, well, this is a very different sort of thing. Well, reincarnation is reincarnation, right? It's still reincarnation. Dalai Lama is thought to be a reincarnation of previous Dalai Lamas, who are thought to be a reincarnation of the Bodhisattva of compassion. Avalokiteshvara is the name in Sanskrit. Tibetan is Chenrezig. But things change in turn. Tibetan Buddhism gets very different from everything, not everything, but things that I've explained to you today, insofar as it's much later. This is all from the early schools, the Pali Canon, these doctrines. This is from the Sutra Pitaka. But that would be the example of the Dalai Lama in terms of reincarnation. And then, of course, in Tibetan Buddhism, there are four different schools, and what the school the Dalai Lama belongs to is not necessarily the same ideas about reincarnation that the other three schools are going to ascribe to. So context makes a big difference in terms of how we look at the fine sort of tuning of these different theories. But yeah, so that's not leads to dissatisfactoriness. I don't know who had their hands up first. So I think you've had yours up first, but then you.
I was just curious if you could elaborate a little bit on the difference between ambition and aspiration, and why is it there's ambition, but aspiration isn't.
Yeah, well, using the word ambition is, I think, aspiration is a way in our English language to try and elucidate what the Buddhists talked about in these early schools as a difference between tirshna, thirst, what we translate as thirst, and chanda, which is a kind of act that doesn't have negative value applied to it. And so it sounds like you're splitting hairs, or you're just dealing in semantics here, I think. I know for students, so this is a question that's come up from students before, and I said, well, I don't get it. What's the difference? And, it's certainly a good thing, right? To want to attain this state for yourself, and if you take the Bodhisattva vow, for example, it's going to be good for other people too, absolutely. Or even if you don't take the Bodhisattva vow, but you become enlightened, you can then teach people and help people, and that's a good thing. But what I think is important to keep in mind is, one, is that they do make a distinction between certain acts that are going to either feed the ego only, and therefore perpetuate more need to feed the ego, like lust, things that greed and envy, that can also have negative effects on other people, right, because of those things. We could probably think of examples of how those might spill out into other people's lives. And acts that don't have those sorts of implications, like intimacy between a couple, right, in the lay Buddhist community, that point I looked at on the Eightfold Path, those 10 precepts. Intimacy or sexual conduct between a couple of a lay Buddhist community is not considered to be thirst or lusting for one another, but it's considered to be an act that's completely acceptable and not leading to further damage to oneself and leading to further bondage in the cycle of rebirth and re-death. And there are all sorts of different acts like this that can actually set oneself up mentally and possibly physically to be prepared for awakening in ways that thirst and greed and lust and so on will never get you prepared for any of that, because they're going to always keep you attached to, clinging to things that distract from the reality, right? That is, your life's really suffering when you're thirsty and greedy, even though you think you're happy because you own all of these things. They lead to delusion, whereas other acts don't do that, I guess is what a Buddhist would say. It's maybe one of the more challenging things, because it looks like a contradiction, I think, within the doctrine itself. Yes?
Karma is often portrayed as being kind of scale independent. It can play itself out over seconds, minutes, hours, months, years, lifetime. And I've often seen these 12 steps of Pentacle Rising as being portrayed also as equally scale independent. The 12 steps can play themselves out over any sort of interval as well. What's being born, what's being died, what's dying is whatever. Manifestation of disposition is occurring at that time as causes, conditions come together, bring it about, and then dissipate and let it go away.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, is that scale independence notion, was that in an original part of this structure as the Buddha conceived of it? Or was that grafted on by later interpretations? And did the Buddha really just see this as just being really lifetime, lifetime, lifetime to lifetime?
No, moment to moment. In fact, just as you've described it, this is the way it's set up here to understand rebirth, I think, in a way to try and see it in the scale of a lifetime, the way that we see it in these 12. But certainly, things change. This is how one of the arguments, right, to people who subscribe to the permanence of the Atman is the Buddha said that we're comprised of these five skandhas, these five aggregates. Nothing in these five is the same now as it will be tomorrow. These things are coming and going, and they're changing all the time. But what's interesting about the doctrine of dependent co-arising, if you look at the list, number one, ignorance about the Four Noble Truths is number one, and it leads to these dispositions, concerns, and intentions. We don't learn much from this list, really, about what the Buddha actually taught. This is probably a later tradition development. And why do we say that? Well, points 2 to 12... starting with the dispositions and ending with the suffering right here, seem to be a way to try to explain why the Four Noble Truths are so important. They start with that. They're latching on to this notion that the Four Noble Truths are the basis for your knowledge, and it's ignorance of that that's going to lead to these things. This is what I think a lot of scholars today would say, is that this is a representation of later traditions trying to meld what they picked up as the theory of causation in the Buddhist teaching, as it fits with what the Buddha's basic teaching was of reality, which is everything is suffering. So that's an important thing to note. And then, more specifically to this idea of scale, things change all the time in the tradition in terms of that, my understanding. Yeah, did we get everyone? Yeah.
I remember you mentioning earlier about the method behind the Four Noble Truths, that you know, there was a mistaken approach to look at it as like a series of bullet points. And
yeah.
That I was wondering if there may be a similar, you know, Vedantic method in the assembly of the five skandhas. I was just thinking about, like, for instance, about the different. Wondering about the distinction between this perceptions and the sensations, and thought maybe that this is in these five skandhas represent a progression intended to help you understand and recognize the doctrine of non-self.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, if I understand you correctly, I think that's right. It's a way to highlight how we change over time, and I think this gets to your question about scale a little bit too. We change over time, over a long time or over a short time. The things that we perceive about the world, about other people, our dispositions about the things that we encounter in the world, and the way in which, you know, we then present ourselves physically before these things and try and structure them. It doesn't have anything to do with the idea of a self, according to what the Buddha said. And absolutely, they're always coming and going. They're always changing over time. There's nothing perfectly eternal there, right? We're all nitya. We're all impermanent. This goes back again to this idea, the foundation of the Four Noble Truths. The doctrine of no self, the doctrine of codependent arising, both help elaborate that, right? I think if it helps, it's useful for me to look at it that way. If we start at the baseline of those first two noble truths, these are just further elaborations of it. And when we get to the bullet points of them and later idea of later tradition, it's kind of scholasticism mapped onto it, right? As a way to for philosophers to argue with one another and to make the case clear, or maybe more complicated, depending on your perspective, about really what the Buddha was talking about. Because at the end of the day, if we go back to where we started this talk with the white handout, it's a pretty clear teaching, right? But then it's unpacked. That second to last paragraph, these four truths are unpacked over centuries with multiple doctrine, you know, countless doctrine. And you go to Tibet, you know, and then it's a very different picture than it is in Japan. And it's a different picture than it is in Buddhism in America. And, you know, things are radically, radically different. It's a challenging cup of tea, you know, to try and get your mind around. Yeah?
I just was going to go back to the very beginning when you were talking about whether Buddhism is a religion or not, given that it doesn't have a god. I just want to know your take. Is it a religion, and how would you define religion?
Oh, boy.
I have a hard time classifying it as a religion. I like thinking about this idea, frankly, and I'm afraid now I'm going to talk too much. But for me, oftentimes, if I try to think about what we need to have in order to have a religion, something to be a religion, I think you need discourse, a sacred discourse, right? That's often recognized as somehow coming from some perfect source. Right. And we see this discourse usually contained in things like, in the Western tradition, a Bible, right? The Torah, the Quran. And then you need practices that are based upon those discourses. The discourse give us certain rituals and things to do, and hopefully give you reasons why you're doing them. And then there's usually a community, right? To practice the discourses that you find. And from that, after that, you often have an institution, I think. And an institution in which there are authority figures who claim to have the capacity or the authority to speak on behalf of the discourses, to explain them to other people because of their training or because of whatever. So, you know, maybe they were given this authority for some reason. I don't know why. Different traditions will give explanations for that. Those four things, to me, usually need to be there in some respect. And there should be flexibility in the way that we define them. I think Christianity, Islam, Judaism fit within there. I don't think Hinduism fits in there very well. I don't think Buddhism fits because we don't... usually the discourse should be perfect, considered to be infallible, and not arguable, right? But you know, I'm open to change and, you know, a viewpoint about this too. And you kind of caught me off guard. I wasn't ready to. But those four things are there, and I think because there's no God concept of the Buddha was human, and that's the appeal of the tradition that for many people, and it makes it very different from a text that was revealed, because you can have, you know. Malunkyaputta come and challenge the Buddha like that, and him deal with him just like any old person would deal with any old person, instead of, you know, having to, you know, go to question the Ten Commandments. As though the Eightfold Path are not commandments; they're recommendations, really. Right? They're not commandments in the sense of the, you know, the Ten Commandments we understand them. They're recommendations to get you where you need to go if you want to go, and so. I have a hard time because of that first point. The discourse not coming from a divine source is usually, but don't hold me to the fire on that one. Yes?
Could you say that consciousness is synonymous with aggregates in terms of words and meaning?
Is synonymous with aggregates?
Right. Is consciousness synonymous with the word aggregates?
Well, they're different words. Aggregates is an aggregate is skanda, is the word the Buddha used, and consciousness is vijnana. So the consciousness is one of the aggregates that produces the person. So it is one of them, but it's not the same thing. It is an aggregate, is what I would say.
So would you say it's a compilation?
The person is. Or consciousness is a comp... I'm not sure.
Consciousness is a compilation.
Consciousness is consciousness, I think. It is its thing. It's a vijnana.
But the Tibetans break it down into like 100 different forms. So well, consciousness can be considered an aggregation of different forms of consciousness.
All five of those aggregates can be broken down. And that's why when you see in the intuitive or in the insight meditation, a monk will meditate on a list of usually 32 parts or more. That's breaking those five down. And yeah, the Tibetans will break it down into, you know, I won't even guess how many, right? Or somebody can tell me how many. All of those things have different realms within the person, and that's how we can split them down. But just in terms of this doctrine right here, as we're getting it today, these are the five aggregates. The five aggregates can have aggregates. I guess I didn't see if that's where you were leading.
Right. Again, you just use the word realm. Can you? Is realm synonymous with aggregate?
Every one of the five aggregates, let me see if I can be more careful. Every one of the five aggregates can be broken down into sub-aggregates. How's that? And they all five aggregates come together to form what the Buddha called the pugdala, or the person. And so the five aggregates have sub-aggregates and perhaps even sub-sub-aggregates in some traditions.
So your definition of the pugdala?
Pugdala means person.
Pug, U-G?
P-U-G-D-A-L-A, yeah.
That's Sanskrit?
That, yep.
Thank you, Anthony.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We do have a date for the final lecture, yes?
Yep, April 22.
April 22nd.
There's extra handouts. People are missing any part of their handouts. There's more here.
What's the last topic?
Death and dying. Oh.